Welcome to Success Story, the most useful podcast in the world. I'm your host, Scott D. Clary. The Success Story podcast is brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. The HubSpot Podcast Network has other amazing podcasts like No Straight Path, hosted by Ashley Menzies Babatunde. Now, by shedding light on the stories behind the shiny resumes, social media highlights, and job titles, No Straight Path aims to humanize success from the millennial perspective. Featuring guests from all walks of life, No Straight Path aims to inspire conversations around the nuanced perspectives of success. Now, if some of these topics hit home, you're going to love this show. Success is all about maximizing happiness. An interview with Esther Agbaji about finding your voice. Success is communal with Yvonne Doc Aswad. Now, if these topics are interesting to you, make sure to check out No Straight Path wherever you listen to your podcast. Today, my guest is Kurt Anderson. Now, Kurt is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, Evil Geniuses and Fantasyland, as well as the best-selling novels You Can't Spell America Without Me, True Believers, Heyday, Turn of the Century, and the podcast Nixon at War. He co-founded Spy Magazine and co-created and hosted Studio 360, a Peabody award-winning public radio show about art and pop culture that aired until 2020. He's also a journalist, former New Yorker columnist and staff writer, Time critic and columnist, New York editor-in-chief and columnist, and has written for television, film, and stage. Now, we spoke about several entrepreneurial ventures he took on over his life, including Insight.com and Studio 360, why we need to make America new again, his argument that over the past several decades, America's political economy has been hijacked by capital supremacists who preached and enacted a return to a pre-New Deal order, and the systems we need to deploy to fix America.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to. And actually, when people speak to me, they often know, oh, you're that radio show guy. Oh, you're the guy who wrote these books. Oh, you're the guy who did Spy Magazine. And yes, those and more. I you know, like lots of my friends, started out as a writer. And then back in the late 80s, started Spy Magazine, which was a kind of slightly insane, but as it turned out, successful entrepreneurial effort to start this magazine back when magazines didn't have the internet to compete with. And it was a satirical magazine. It was nonfiction. It was journalism, but often savage, always fun and funny journalism. We did that, made a big enemy out of, among other people, Donald Trump, back when he was just a, you know, bum in New York. So did that, and then went on to write books and do other things and movies and plays and so forth, but also was along the way starting companies like this Inside.com, which was a online and print magazine publication that covered the media industries back at the turn of the century, back in 99 2000 2001. Did an email newsletter called Very Short List that was then sold, as it happened, to Jared Kushner and the Observer Company in the 2000s. So yeah, I am a writer. That's what my passport says, and that's the main thing I have always been. But I have also, along the way, both in print and then in digital land, started companies, sold them sometimes, and got out of them other times, and wrote them down to the end other times.
So, you know, there's quite a few writers that don't start companies. So walk me through, you know, you started off as a writer. You've obviously done a lot of things. And I also want to dovetail this into what gives you inspiration as to what to work on next. I'm sure that habit and that mindset has carried you through your career. So pick one of the many things that you've worked on. What prompted you to go into building something that was yourself and not just writing?
Yeah, I mean, Spy was the first, and of the things I've done, maybe the most influential of the businesses I've started. My partner and I at the time, Graydon Carter, and then my third partner was the business guy, Tom Phillips, with Spy, and actually my fourth partner, for that matter, my wife, Ann Kramer, who was the marketing and ad sales person. But we had this. We'd grown up loving magazines, right? I mean, whether it was Esquire in the '60s or National Lampoon when it came out, or there were these magazines that we just loved getting and helped define our sensibilities. Mad Magazine when we were little kids. And we were both working at Time Magazine together as guys in our 20s and thought, like, man, we don't have a favorite magazine anymore. Why is that? You know, magazines are doing great. And by God, you know, 80s and 90s were in some ways a golden age. But we didn't have a favorite. And we didn't. And we had been in journalism and magazine journalism in New York just long enough to hear all kinds of great stories that never got reported, right? That there was no internet. There was no... things got not buried and covered up exactly, but effectively buried and covered up because the New York Times, for instance, was kind of a monopoly hegemon, you know? And so there were all these stories that didn't get reported. There was all this fun way and satirical way of reporting things and looking at the world that wasn't being done in journalism. It was being done, you know, on the Letterman show, which we forget, I think, was a really a kind of game changer in terms of sensibility back in the 80s when that was getting going. So we said, we just started talking about, like, what would this magazine be even before we were serious about starting it. And then we said, wow, we've got an idea here. Let's get somebody who knows about business with us, some people who know about business, and start raising money. And the timing was great, as it turned out, because there was no internet yet, right? I mean, literally, when we started Spy Magazine, the internet had not been invented. So we had, once we had this idea for a thing, this magazine, the motto of which, the slogan of which was smart, fun, funny, fearless, that would be mostly nonfiction, looking at the world, a monthly, based and about New York originally, and then the whole of America within a couple of years. We had this idea of a thing that wasn't being done that we wanted for ourselves. And really that's the key of anything I've ever done is I want to write a book. I want to start a company. I want to do a thing. I want to serve myself, really. It's something I want. I realized fairly early on that you can be in a business where you're second guessing about, like, what would that kind of person want? What would this kind of person want? But you're second guessing about what people who aren't you would want, as opposed to what would I, making the dog food you want to eat that you're the dog for, right? And so that was really what Spy was about, and it was risky in all kinds of ways, and I didn't particularly think of myself as a risk-taking person. I'd kind of played by the book more or less, other than, you know, being an adolescent. But until then, in terms of work, it seemed possible at the time. Partly, I think, also because it was the early part of the long boom where we knew people who were making lots and lots of money on Wall Street in the late 80s, and they had money to spare to throw into this crazy enterprise that we had in mind, and we were able to raise money that way, and it took off, and it was successful, and we were breaking even within 3 years, which is kind of amazing for a standalone
brand new publication.
Magazine.
Yeah, and you never had experience building a business before. That was your first.
I had not. Graydon had started a little magazine in Canada, but a very different kind, and so he had been an editor and had done that. But no, we, you know, as people say about things, and it's so true of us in that case, we were too stupid to know how, what a long shot it was, you know.
And then after that, you are obviously a serial content creator. You went into Studio 360, decided to start an award-winning public radio show. just decided to start one, but it ended up going well.
Well, and before that, I had a little less than three-year moment in between Spy and that and writing a novel. After my big job, that I was hired for because we'd done such a good job for Spy, the people who had recently bought New York Magazine made me editor of that, then fired me 2.5 years after hiring me because their whole thing was that they had wanted to be edgier. They wanted to be edgier, which was the sort of the word of the day. And I guess I gave it too much edge for them and offended some of the owner, Henry Kravis's pals on Wall Street, and got booted from that, which you know, and it was a thing my mother always said and said at the time, well, you know, Kurt, when doors close, other doors open. And I thought, yeah, sure. Right, Mom. Thanks. But in fact, I decided, okay, I've always wanted to write a novel. I'm, you know, in my late 30s. It's kind of now or never, I felt. And so I, you know, started writing a novel, and I had, you know, some severance and some time, and actually getting booted from that job, I think probably turned me into a book writer in a way that I might not have ever had. The timing may never have been right if I just kept doing that and kept editing magazines and been a magazine editor as magazines began to die. I might have taken that path rather than becoming more really of a, you know, essentially an independent creator, you know, which is mostly what I've been. Now, yes, you mentioned the radio show, which came along right after I'd written my first novel. And again, that was just came out of the blue. I mean, I'd never aspired to do that. But the people who ran public radio decided, you know, maybe you can do this. We have this idea for a show. And so we did, and it worked. And it was, I changed lanes. Was one of the many lane changes I made along the way, and it worked out. It was a matter of taking risks, and not crazy risks, but risks that I had done it once, right, with Spy, and hey, that worked out okay. So it gave me the whatever courage, belief that yeah, it can work out, you know, to do that. I mean, there are all kinds of things and projects apart from being fired from a job that I've done along the way that, you know, didn't work out. So it's not as though, hey, everything he does turns to gold.
These are just the things that you talk about because they're the ones that actually, the ones that actually did well. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Or had some kind of influence or whatever. Yeah, yes, indeed.
Of course. So after Studio 360, obviously, that was a large portion of your life. You did that for 20 years.
Yeah.
It's a long time to be building up a radio show.
Well, yeah, it was. Although, it's interesting. I mean, it was by that time, especially after the one time when I really worked, you know, for somebody and got fired, I didn't, like, say to myself exactly, like, you will never have one boss again. But I kind of did. And I always, even though I was doing the radio show, was also writing books. And doing other projects and writing screenplays and so forth. So it was an important gig, but it was kind of like an important gig rather than my defining one job. You know, I really, you know, these days, obviously, all kinds of people, you know, it's a gig economy and people have a portfolio of jobs and occupations and clients and everything. Well, I stumbled my way into doing that, you know, back in 2000 when I said, okay, I'm going to be a book author and I'm going to have this radio show, but I'm also going to help start this little media operation here or work on this play over here. So, it's like having whatever, how many legs a stool needs, 3 or 4, yeah. You know?
And then after Studio 360, just because I think, Inside.com is still functioning and around. At what point was that?
That was 1999. My friend, okay. Michael Hirshhorn, who had been my number two when I ran New York Magazine, and okay. I had this idea after I kind of referred to a thing like it in this novel I'd written called Turn of the Century set in the near future. He said, well, let's actually do that. Let's do this online thing that covers the media and entertainment business. Which wasn't really being done that well. I mean, there were the trade publications like Hollywood Reporter and Variety and things in the print world, but it wasn't really this exploding new internet media space and spaces wasn't really being covered in the way that we thought it could be and should be, with you know, journalistic aggressiveness and entertaining sensibility and in this daily way. So anyway, that's what that was, and we started and it was, we thought, it's funny now, but in 1999, sort of at what turned out to be the end of the first dot-com boom, right? We thought, wow, this internet, we're missing it. We were missing it. Let's start our own band before it's too late to start a band, kind of thing. And so we had this idea, and at this hot, hot moment of 98, 99, it was, you know, way too easy to raise money for such a thing. And we raised a lot of money and hired an amazing staff, and for a couple of years, you know, had a great early internet publication. You know, before, I mean, again, it was before broadband, was barely there. It was before there was any advertising on the line. So it was nuts. I mean, the charitable thing way to describe it is ahead of its time, but it was indeed really good, you know, for its brief life.
Well, it had a brief life, and not, but it is still around. So obviously it wasn't the victim of many other companies that raised money in the dot-com. So you had something under the hood, which was already good, because I know there's enough companies that probably didn't and still raise a lot of money. So after this, you finished. Okay, so I didn't realize that was sort of, you were finished with Inside.com by the time, you know.
2001, yeah. I think 2001, we sold it to Primedia, this Perfect. Company called Primedia, which ironically was the company that had owned New York Magazine and fired me. I was done with Inside in 2001, and then fully engaged in the radio show, which started in 2000. And
this whole time you're writing. You're always
writing. And I'm still, I am indeed. Still writing books.
I was going to say, the one thing that I thought was so impressive about the works that you produce, it just seems like you have such an intimate understanding of the topic. And the only reason why I said now you're a career writer, so it may seem like, of course, that's what he does for a living. But I mean, the amount of people that write books just about their domain, they've lived their whole life, they've written a book about their domain, and that's the one thing they publish. So as you're an experienced, you know, obviously award-winning author, what's your process for deciding? You said before you want to learn about something, you want to talk about something, that's what you do. But how do you really get into the weeds on something?
Well, I mean, novels are one thing, and that's in terms of, and I'd written, you know, a small little nonfiction book right after the crash, for instance, about called Reset, that was about what I thought, how we might use the opportunity of the 2008-2009 crash and recession as an opportunity to reset. But mostly I was writing novels, and those, you know, in my case, I get an idea for a character or a scene or a time and just begin thinking about it for a long time and letting it simmer and grow into something. Nonfiction books, these last two I've written, you know, Fantasyland and Evil Geniuses, kind of start the same way, but they, I won't say they necessarily come to life quicker, but they're more focused, right? I mean, you have this idea with Fantasyland, as opposed to characters or scenes or milieus or times or what images or the way fiction germinates. So Fantasyland, it was like, wow, this country has become a lot less committed to empirical reality in my lifetime. Why is that? You know, and so
investigate that and go.
Let's investigate that. How'd that happen? At first, I I'd written a novel set in the 60s, 1960s at the time. I thought, oh, I think it's something to do with that and how anything goes and find your own truth and all that stuff that grew out of the 60s and 70s. That has something to do with it. But then I realized, wait, no, this is a deeper, longer history. I mean, I was really not. Didn't start it as a history book, and it became a history book because I realized there's a lot about America and Americans and the American idea going all the way back hundreds of years that when it got out of control in a certain way, as in my telling, in the last 50 years, it led to the post-truth, post-fact, fake news, all the world that we are now find ourselves in, that it got us here. And again, I started thinking about that book in the early 2010, started writing it in 2014, turned it in, manuscript in, before Donald Trump was even nominated for president. So as it turned out, I was, you know, I, 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 I'm very grateful to my publisher, who said, when I told her about this book that I might do next, she said, well, maybe do that now. That sounds timely. And thank God she did, because it came out just in time for to help, you know, explain how we got to the land of Trump, the fantasy land of Trump. So then Evil Geniuses came along, really. People responded to that book. And I realized as I was finishing it and as I was going out in the world and talking about it, that my theory of how we went wrong. I mean, one of the Fantasyland subtitle is How America Went Haywire. The Evil Geniuses subtitle is The Unmaking of America. And I realized I had told kind of half of a story that I had to tell, which is, wow, we have an iffy relationship to the truth, and that allows for all kinds of problems if it gets out of control, of people not believing in climate change, for instance, or not believing in vaccines, or whatever the not believing true things or believing false things you're talking about. But I realize there's another half of that, of how this was, how how we got so unfair in this country, how we got so unequal, how prosperity began going only to the very wealthy, people like me. Not that I'm very wealthy, but I'm in the, I don't know, top 20% of people have done okay in the last 50 years. And so I realized, beyond this kind of exploration of the irrational in America, that there was this very, very rational thing that has been done and changed the system in the last 40 or 50 years. And so I wanted to figure out, like, how'd that happen? And that was, you know, Evil Geniuses involves more of a, you know, how did I miss this? How was I not paying enough attention as it was happening in the 80s and 90s, you know, kind of, and just explaining so I understand what happened, right? How the ideas of how the system should be fair for everyone and all boats should rise and the New Deal idea, how that was just wiped away and we ended up where we've ended up, trying to figure it out, you know, trying to figure out how it happened and then trying to, you know, write it in a lucid enough way that, you know, normal people could understand it and be persuaded, and that I'm not an economist or haven't studied economics since I was in college, but, you know, so that the economists of the world and the political economists of the world wouldn't think I was an idiot. And so I spent a couple of years researching it and a year or so writing it, and here I am. So I feel like, okay, my nonfiction work here is done. They really work as kind of two volumes of if you think America has kind of gone off the rails in the last while, here's my one explanation, and they are kind of a two-volume history in that sense.
I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, HubSpot. Now, while you're listening to this podcast, you're probably doing something else too. Mastering the art of working out, shaving like no one's watching. We get it. When you're having conversations with your customers, the same is probably true for them. They're IMing their teams, mentally planning date nights. So growing conversations beyond that moment can be challenging. HubSpot helps you go beyond the moment by connecting you and your teams so you can access the exact same data and see the full customer picture. What motivates them, what their expectations are, and how you can blow them out of the water. With powerful tools that connect marketing, sales, ops, and service, HubSpot's powerful CRM platform powers you and your teams to transform customer moments into extraordinary customer experiences. Learn how HubSpot can help your business grow better at HubSpot.com.
And you break it down. I appreciate that, because I think that everybody that looks at the current state of America and wonders, you know, how did we get here? But you break it down, you know, you mentioned how did I not see this? And I was actually watching a few interviews to research for this show, and that, you know, how did I not see this? I was living through it, and I'm sure you have a couple thoughts on that. But also, the book goes way back. So you even speak about the founding ideology of America and how that's potentially led to what caused the opinions that would have prompted people to almost have a knee-jerk reaction, you know, in the 70s. I think that, you know, when I was reading through, you were speaking about understanding the mindset of the people, the CEOs, the executives in the 60s, 70s, and what's led them to potentially do some of the things that you speak about in the book. So
yeah,
First, I just want to tee it up. So I think that what you had mentioned, there was a little clip about America being founded based on the ideas of newness and innovation. And I think I just wanted you to speak about that and what that's all about.
Sure. Well, again, I did sort of, it's not quite as much of the long view as Fantasyland, but I do go back, as you say, to the beginnings and how the idea of America, even before it was the United States, was all about the new. And, you know, this was the new world. Well, let's include Canada. And I hear that Canadian accent in your voice. And I take you into the whole North American idea. But it was about a new world. Let's go to this new place and figure out new ways to live and new ways to do things and then new ways to manufacture things and new ways to create a government and new ways. It was always about the new for better and worse, but mostly for better, really. And for hundreds of years. And certainly in the 19th and 20th century.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Just a quick question. Have you ever had one of those oh no moments when you realize that you accidentally deleted a huge file? Or worse, your whole computer dies. I know I have. It's happened to me a lot, but don't sweat it. The sponsor of today's episode, Backblaze, they have your back. It is unlimited backups for all your Macs, your PCs, or even your whole company. And it's really affordable, under $100 a year. If you're running a business, they take the stress out of protecting everyone's data. If you need more bells and whistles for compliance, so on and so forth, they have enterprise options too. Honestly, losing data sucks, but Backblaze makes getting it back easy. They have restored billions of files. They offer tons of restore options, including rapid recovery in an event of data loss or ransomware. And you can access your backed up data from everywhere and anywhere in the world using their web app, iOS, or Android apps. It's been recommended by the New York Times, Inc., Macworld, PC World, LifeWire, Wired, Tom's Guide, 9to5 Mac, and tons more. And best, you can try it fully featured with no risk at backblaze.com/story. They set up that link for all Success Story podcast listeners. That is a no-risk free trial at backblaze.com/story. Seriously, back up your stuff. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Today's show is brought to you by 1Password. Now listen, we all have that one friend who's constantly forgetting passwords and needing help to get into their accounts. I have a solution. It's called 1Password. 1Password is the award-winning password manager trusted by millions of users and companies like IBM and Slack to keep logins, credit cards, and other private info safe in an encrypted vault that only you can access. No more sticky notes with passwords or using the same password everywhere. I've been using 1Password for a year now, and I can't recommend it enough. It saves me time from having to reset passwords and gives me peace of mind knowing my info is secure. With convenient features like automatic password generation and login autofill, 1Password takes the hassle out of passwords. You can use it on all your devices, iOS, Android, Mac, PC. Everything syncs seamlessly. And with top-notch security audits and encryption, your data stays private. So do yourself a favor and check out 1Password today. Go to 1Password.com/Clary and get a 2-week free trial. Let 1Password remember all of your logins for you so you can remember what really matters. That's 1Password.com/Clary for 2 weeks free.
America became the font of newness, and people wanted to go there to create new lives, create new selves, create to not be tied to the old ways and the old world. And again, that was mostly good, in my view. And then somewhere along the line, I mean, and certainly provoked by what happened in the 1960s. The 1960s, as I describe it in Evil Geniuses, was this kind of moment of just overwhelming newness all at once. I mean, whether it was the space age and the Apollo program and all of that, like, top-down newness. And then there was the counterculture and hippies and the New Age and all that and civil rights and urban uprisings. And man, I mean, it's hard to, you know, I was just a little kid at the time, but it was a decade of just raging newness to the max that naturally discombobulated a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And so there was to some degree, a natural organic reaction after that in the early 70s to like, hold your horses, let's just calm down a little bit, let's stop with the constant new, kind of the shock of the new. And so, and you mentioned the CEOs and billionaires, or I guess at that point, not even probably 100 millionaires, mm-hmm. There weren't many billionaires at the time. But anyway, the moneyed class and CEOs felt in like, 1969, 1970, as environmental regulation came in, and just this anti-business sense took hold. A lot of them were afraid that, you know, they were going to be washed away by some kind of socialist revolution, which in retrospect is kind of nuts and hysterical of them, but somewhat understandable that they felt like, oh my God, we're just going to be, our time is, unless we fight back somehow, our time is over. And so they did. They got together, a bunch of them, including Charles Koch, most famously, but others, and the Business Roundtable, this new thing that was this sort of new kind of organization of CEOs of the largest companies getting together to lobby and they created a new kind of, you know, economically libertarian, ultra pro-capitalist right with think tanks and its own media platforms and on and on and on and lobbyists and so forth. And used this, like, this exhaustion, this post-60s exhaustion of, oh, let's go back to the way it used to be, okay? Let's go back to the way it used to be. And very brilliantly and cleverly, with Ronald Reagan as a front man, sold this idea of, yeah, let's take America back to the way it was. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't say back to the way it was before civil rights, before women's rights, but that was part of it. That was the unsaid at the time.
A recurring theme that we see manifesting again and again.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but this idea of, oh, let's go back to good old small town America when government wasn't in everybody's faces and government was competent and all those things, was a very successful political cell. And so the characters, the stars of Evil Geniuses are these very rational rich guys who not only within a few years kept them, saw that they weren't being washed away, that the free enterprise system wasn't being dismantled, and they very quickly sort of, you know, they were no longer in existential jeopardy, but they at a certain point in the late 70s decided, well, let's keep going, let's see how far we can go and really transform the system to really, you know, roll back the old New Deal paradigm of you know, the rich pay high taxes and we have aggressive antitrust and all the rest. And they just kept on going. And before too long, there was no Democratic Party that sort of positing an alternative to that. So everybody agreed, right? I mean, the Democrats and the Republicans didn't really, by the 90s, certainly, by the age of Bill Clinton, didn't really disagree about economics or social policy very much. You know, the only things they disagreed about were the cultural things and therefore the system and all of its premises about what was fair and unfair and how much inequality we could stand or countenance was changed in a generation.
And this is a really a death by a thousand cuts, because I'm sure if you go back, you can trace back, you know, specific action items and various, you know, government programs and whatnot that will actually have this compound almost butterfly effect to things that we're experiencing today. And like you said, all the things that we question, how did we get like this? This has not been monumental major policy decisions. These are just small things that have added up over time.
Totally right. And that is, again, to my whatever credit, why we didn't see it so much, because so much of it were, as you say, these death by a thousand cuts, these tiny little things that didn't seem like such big deals. Yes, Ronald Reagan was elected and the Congress reduced income taxes by half the rates. That was a big thing. But that was one part of it. All these small things that who unless you were a kind of specialist in regulation or tax codes, you just didn't pay much attention to. Like the SEC change in the early 1980s that allowed companies to buy their own stock shares. Mm-hmm. That hadn't happened, right? Since the New Deal, since we set up the modern system of regulating equities and securities and finance. Suddenly, no, go ahead, buy your own stock. And that just was this just profound transformation where now, you know, and for the last, you know, generation, most big companies spend most of their earnings on buying their own stock, which always struck me as like, hey, how did this happen? This didn't used to happen, did it? This doesn't seem kosher. And then I went back and looked at the history of this little change of an SEC rule that nobody paid, didn't make big headlines.
Massive
at the time.
Change. So just massive just repercussions. Changes,
and it's a massive change. Or another example like that is well, they didn't lower the minimum wage. They just stopped raising the minimum wage and let inflation do the business of lowering it, right? Yeah. So back in the day, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, the minimum wage was the equivalent of $10, $12, almost $15. Because Congress kept raising it. Then they stopped it, went down to basically $7, and where it stayed for 40 years. On and on and on. There's dozens, scores, hundreds of changes that either were invisible because they were done by stealth, like not raising the minimum wage, or like, what's this? 401ks? What? I don't know, whatever. That just nobody noticed. You know, but in the aggregate, they changed the system, in a relatively few years.
Now, so you go into a lot of details, examples, and you broke the book down, I guess, into it says five different parts. I don't know if that's correct or not. This is just from my research. If that's accurate, let me know. But so you go through these four parts. It is really just like the history leading up to modern day. And then the fifth part I thought was interesting, Make America New Again. So this is the result of the past 40 years. And speak to me about what that means exactly.
Well, I mean, lots of our politics and our divisions today are arguments over what was bad or good about the past, right? Mm-hmm. And there are aspects of the past we can't bring back, don't want to bring back, you know, white supremacy, women can't do anything but stay at home. I could go on, you know, gay people can't admit they're gay. But there are certain parts of there's a certain part of the past, which is to say our political economic past, when things were fairer and we had this, you know, during the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, this national consensus about what was fair and what wasn't fair and how big corporate power should be and on and on and on, that there's a lot there to look at now, which isn't to say, you know, it's a very different world with a very different economy, and most especially the digital revolution has changed things, but we did it better. You know, it was fairer. Many boats did tend to rise together until around 1980. But here we are in this new digital world where well-paying jobs have been destroyed by both globalization and technology, and now digital technology, and doesn't look to most of the experts that I've read like they're going to be replaced by new, good, better jobs the way they were in the early 20th century, the way they were in the early 19th century. And yes, there was disturbances caused and pain caused by all those industrial revolutions, but eventually people left the farm and went to factories. Eventually people left factories and went to office jobs. It seems like there's a good possibility, I think probability, that it's different this time. So you have the chance for this new digital world and this new AI world to keep eliminating jobs and making the production of things and services more and more and more efficient. But how are people going to live? You know, how are people going to have dignity? How we are at this crossroads where we have to figure out how the future is going to be a decent one for most people. And I think, I really do think it's a crossroads, which is to say there is the opportunity for amazing plenty, you know, for solving, as John Maynard Keynes said 100 years ago, the economic problem, which is to say there's now enough for everybody, right? I do this sort of thought experiment in the course of the book saying, talking about America too, not saying let's divide up all wealth and income equally. That's never going to happen. Probably should never happen. But let's just, as an illustration, if you divide up all of the wealth and all of the income in the United States equally by household, everybody is upper middle class. Everybody is upper middle class. Each household gets $800,000 of wealth, and each household has an income of $130,000, $140,000. Sounds good, right? Again, I'm not saying we should do that, but it is a starting point to say how wealthy we are and how dysfunctionally and unfairly all of that wealth and income is now shared. We're at a place where we have to rejigger our system to make it a more fair one, as, you know, not unlike other countries, like, say, the Scandinavian countries, like, say, Canada, even. Before we get to this place where it becomes this, you know, dystopian digital feudalism, which is where we're headed if we don't pretty radically change the system, I think.
I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, NordVPN. Now, if you've ever missed out on your favorite shows because it's not available in your country, or if you're trying to keep your private time private, you don't want people spying on what you're doing, well, let me introduce you to NordVPN. If you're bored of US Netflix, why not take a spin in the UK? Use NordVPN, click of a button, you can do just that. You want to watch your favorite anime, you don't have to travel to Japan. NordVPN brings it right to you with 5,000 plus server options. No show is out of reach. And of course, we all love to binge TV and Netflix, but privacy is a big deal too. NordVPN keeps your information encrypted, so you never have to worry about your IP or location getting out. They've also doubled down on keeping you safe with their new threat protection feature. Say goodbye to intrusive web ads and malware. Even if you download an infected file, threat protection kicks in and deletes it before it makes a mess of your computer. And don't forget, if you're trying NordVPN, there is literally no risk to you. They have a 30-day money-back guarantee. Give it a try. If you like it, great. If you don't, they'll issue you a refund. You can pretend it never happened. They gave a special discount for Success Story podcast listeners. They gave a special offer. So go to my link at nordvpn.com/successstory to get your subscription started today.
I was just going to ask, because you know, I want people to go in and obviously and read more, because I think it's a really interesting topic. But the end result of 40 years of unfettered capitalism, it has some implications. Do you have any ideas after doing this research, writing this book, about how we could achieve a better system, or are we too far gone?
Well, we'll see. I mean, there's a lot of problems and it's not an easy slog. But one of the things, by looking at this history of how the paradigm was shifted and how the system was transformed fairly quickly over the generation from, let's say, 1978 to 1998, right? That, like, wow, let's do what they did, but for our side, right? I mean, it's possible. It's a heavy slog, and it's a long-term process if it's to happen. But and again, I'm serious when I say, look what they did and learn things. Keep your eye on the prize, right? And keep at it, and keep at it, and keep at it, and don't let yourself get too diverted by things that aren't really going to make lives much better. And in my view, stick to the economics, which the evil geniuses did, you know. I don't think, I'm still, you know, 50.1% hopeful. I'm not without hope that we can get there. And, you know, the politics and economics of the last 9 months have actually given me some, you know, sent me to all the way to 51-52% hopeful.
That's pretty optimistic. Oh, very good. I always like to ask a couple of rapid fire career questions just to bring some insights out of you. Was there anything else that you wanted to bring up? Any points in the book that we didn't touch on that were major relevant points? I know that we really broke a lot of it down.
No, I mean, it's I think in terms of an introduction, I mean, part of it, as I say, for people who don't feel like they're particularly left on economics, you know, I wasn't either. I was always a kind of capital D democratic centrist, until I really stopped and said, like, yeah, that's easy for me to say, I've done fine, right? Let's really look at what happened and how this happened. And so I think it's a for being a sort of polemical economic history, it's pretty fair and balanced, dare I say it. So, but yeah, I mean, I think if this subject interests you at all, I think, you know,
it should. I think it should introduce more people, to be honest.
You can learn a lot, because I learned a lot. And really, I've just recapitulated, you know, my 3 years of learning in this book.
Very good. Okay. Some rapid fire insights out of you. Go as long or as short as you'd like for these. What was the biggest challenge that you've had in your career, and how did you overcome it?
Well, I guess the one that felt like a big challenge, because it was so sort of spectacular, was getting fired from this job, because it was in the newspapers, and, you know, it was like being shot out of a cannon that you didn't know you were in until they lit the fuse. But in fact, I mean, because it was so spectacular and quick, it wasn't ultimately that hard, even though it was shocking and disorienting and a bummer. So I guess that was the single biggest. If it's a lightning round, that's the biggest.
That's a good note. It's good.
I didn't feel damaged by it, or like I didn't go into a, you know, year long depression. I just, you know, got back on the horse.
Yeah, I just like to bring that out because you know, people that are younger in their career, I think everybody who's achieved any level of success has been fired in one way or another. But you know, sometimes for people that are younger, it feels like it is the end of the world. What would be one thing that you would tell your 20-year-old self?
I would say, and I knew it by the time I was 25 or 28, but basically learn patience. You know, I would say that as a young person, I certainly didn't have enough patience. And maybe that's the nature of being young. And by the time I was 30, I kind of had developed some patience, so it was okay. But just, you know, calm down. You know, stay on the right track. You'll get there. You'll get what you need. Don't be so anxious.
Who would be one person, excuse me, that had a major impact on your life? It can be family. It can be somebody in your professional circle. And what did they teach you?
I was really lucky in terms of my family. My parents were like excellent parents back in the day when the phrase helicopter parents didn't exist, and my parents were certainly not helicopter parents. They gave me, you know, I knew I was cared about, but I had a very long leash. But I would say the single person who was most was just a great person to have in my life was my first boss, who was this guy called Gene Shalit, who was a big famous guy at the time. He was on the Today Show every day when that was a big deal. And he was the culture guy and the movie reviewer. And he just hired me out of college to write for him, to research for him, to hang around with him. He was a great boss. He was just the model of a generous, great boss. He was certainly, and so he was very generous to me and got me this book deal for this book I published when I was 26 years old, incredibly generously. And was just, His model of kindness and decency and mentorship, to the degree I might have been okay on those scores in all of the jobs and when I employed people and helped people, but he certainly, as a first boss, proving to me that this is what a boss can be, was an incredibly important influence.
What would be one source that you'd recommend? Could be a book, podcast, obviously. None of your own that you'd recommend people go
check
out.
I got nothing for you. If it's not my own, I got nothing. Well, let's see. What do I listen to? I mean, right now, I mean, in terms of, are we talking about living life better or just being
anything.
Interested?
Your interpretation.
I think, I mean, my friend, and it's not just because he's my friend, but John Heilemann, has a podcast he's been doing for now a year, I guess, called Hell and High Water, which is just an exemplary podcast. He really does it well and right, and uses, and they tend to be an hour long, but they don't ever feel like they drag. He does it really beautifully, and I think understands the difference between interview and conversation, which is to say these are more like conversations. It's really excellent. And podcasts, as you know, by doing this, it's a wonderful time to be. It's wonderful to be in a medium as it's still finding its own form and shape.
Agreed.
Where
yeah.
There's not absolute rules of this is the way it's got to be or that's the way it's got to be. When it's still, you know, whatever we're in, the early 10, 20 years of this form, and I find it very exciting when, you know, things like John's do it,
you know,
in his own way, and it's great. So I find it great because it's weekly, and I find both as a creator and as a consumer, I find daily these days, you know, when we're so deluged by content and information and all that, I find the weekly frequency kind of more my cup of tea.
One thing that you mentioned that I thought was that really resonated with me, and it just reminded me when you said, you know, the medium hasn't been defined yet, is that you create content that you would consume yourself, or you investigate ideas, or you build businesses, or you write books. And I think that that's probably one of the one things that anybody who's creating content, that's something that they should take away. And that's why I built this podcast. That's why I hope whoever is creating content or listening to this and being inspired creates something that they want to create, because you know this, like if you don't love it, if you don't live it, if it's not something that's for you, and you're trying to build it for something like someone else, it's a tough, it's a tough hill to climb if it's something that's like really core to who you are.
So well, that totally. Really, really no, it's no fun for the creators, but again, and it can be called authenticity, but it's a form of that. It's like, wow, you are really interested in this. You are really curious about this. You really wanted to talk to this person. That comes across, and I think yeah, that's if I have advice for people, whether or not they're creating media, whatever they're doing, like you better like this, and you better be doing it for you better be a customer of whatever it is you're selling, or you know, maybe you won't fail, but the likelihood of failure is higher, and in any case, you're not going to have fun doing it.
Yeah, very good. What does success mean to you?
Feeling as though you've given it your best shot, whatever it is, and feeling like you have been kind along the way, and grateful as it comes to an end. My older brother who recently died, always said that if he had a religion, it was gratitude. And I always like, yeah, that's kind of right. But as he got older, as I get older, I thought like that. Yes, that's it. Is if you want to end up feeling as though you haven't committed too many unforced errors, and that you're grateful for the people who have helped you and for life itself. So that's what I would say.
And most importantly, how do people connect with you? Website, social, where do they get the book, all of that?
They get the book wherever they buy books. and there's a paperback edition of Evil Geniuses being published in August, so they can wait for that and get a beautiful new paperback with some updates. But Evil Geniuses. Twitter is where is the social place I am most active. I'm at KB Andersen, S-E-N. I've got a nice website. That is KurtAnderson.com, and they can get a hold of me through that or see what I'm up to.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Just a quick question. Have you ever had one of those oh no moments when you realize that you accidentally deleted a huge file? Or worse, your whole computer dies. I know I have. It's happened to me a lot, but don't sweat it. The sponsor of today's episode, Backblaze, they have your back. It is unlimited backups for all your Macs, your PCs, or even your whole company. And it's really affordable, under $100 a year. If you're running a business, they take the stress out of protecting everyone's data. If you need more bells and whistles for compliance, so on and so forth, they have enterprise options too. Honestly, losing data sucks, but Backblaze makes getting it back easy.
They have restored billions of files. They offer tons of restore options, including rapid recovery in an event of data loss or ransomware. And you can access your backed up data from everywhere and anywhere in the world using their web app, iOS, or Android apps. It's been recommended by the New York Times, Inc., Macworld, PC World, LifeWire, Wired, Tom's Guide, 9to5Mac, and tons more. And best, you can try it fully featured with no risk at backblaze.com/story. They set up that link for all Success Story podcast listeners. That is a no-risk free trial at backblaze.com/story. Seriously, back up your stuff. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success.